You may proceed.
May it please the court, William Winters for the Commonwealth. At this time, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
All right. You're the first lawyer today. I'm going to make a notice. The first lawyer that has done that. And for the sake of all the other lawyers that are here, if you ever expect me to help you with your rebuttal time, you got to ask for it. Thank you for doing so.
Thank you. Your Honor, this is a sexually violent predator civil commitment case where the jury did not find clear and convincing evidence that Brady Crawford is a sexually violent predator. But the jury made an uninformed decision in this case because the trial court abused its discretion when it excluded two victims from testifying about how Crawford had raped them. The testimony of these victims, whose initials are MJ and AG, would have shown that Crawford raped them on separate occasions, 5 years apart, in a very similar manner. He manipulated each of them to get into his car, drove them to a place where they were isolated and helpless, and then forcefully had sex with them against their will. And AG was raped while her 10-month-old child was in Crawford's car. That evidence helps prove that Crawford has the mental abnormality and personality disorder that the Commonwealth's expert psychologist, Dr. Nevin, diagnosed him with, that is sexual sadism disorder and antisocial personality disorder. Because that evidence shows real-life examples of the existence, the effect, and the duration of those two disorders of Crawford. And that evidence also shows that Crawford has committed multiple sexual offenses over a period of time and is therefore likely to commit sexually violent acts again. But the jury did not get to hear that evidence. Instead, all the jury heard was that Crawford was simply convicted of rape in 2012 with no factual details about that rape. And then the jury heard the conclusions of the expert psychologist and had to just take her word for it without getting to hear the facts upon which she based her conclusion.
Well, actually, all they had was the hearsay that was embedded in Nevin's opinion. And all you were seeking to do is to put on the evidence on the merits, as opposed to them only hearing hearsay embedded in an expert opinion.
Well, no, Your Honor, the jury did not hear any hearsay that Dr. Nevin relied
on. They heard the opinion based upon hearsay statements, and you're wanting to put in the actual statements from the victim, so it's not hearsay, to make sure that the expert opinion is, in fact, as sound as it appears to be.
Right. Well, the details that Dr. Nevin relied on, such as the factual details of the rape itself, the jury, she did not testify to that.
Right.
As to the specific details of that.
Well,
so the jury just hears the conclusion that she based her opinion on without hearing the underlying details that form the basis of her opinion. And so the Commonwealth sought to present those underlying details so that the jury could fully and adequately weigh the expert's opinion to decide if that met clear and convincing evidence, and also to hear the specific conduct of Crawford in his sexual offending behavior.
If we were to agree with you that the information was relevant, we still have the difficulty of determining whether or not the trial court properly weighed prejudicial impact versus probative value, which I frequently think is your toughest call, because I've been a trial judge. I might have made a different ruling. But don't we have to give deference to this trial judge's ruling?
No. Here the trial judge abused his discretion because rule of evidence, Virginia Rule of Evidence 2:402A, mandates that if evidence is relevant, it's admissible unless there are certain exclusions that apply. And this court had, of course, in Egan versus Butler and Lee versus Spoden, and reversed trial courts for holding that evidence was too prejudicial. And this court reversed those trial courts and remanded the cases and said, no, that evidence is relevant and it's not unfairly prejudicial. And here the trial court failed to distinguish between prejudice and unfair prejudice, and therefore didn't properly balance the test. It failed to give the significant weight to the probative value that was the victim's testimony, and it gave undue weight to prejudicial effect without distinguishing it from unfair prejudice.
Can I ask you this question? I have in my notes the court's ruling on page 361 that it would inflame the jury, perhaps. Was there anything more strong than that about the prejudicial effect?
No.
That strikes me as a rather tepid ruling, and then the court goes on to say, and it's irrelevant.
Right, and the trial judge said that it was as common as that it would perhaps inflame the jury, which is why I think it shows that he wasn't looking at unfair prejudice. He wasn't saying that the jury would rely on or make a decision on improper grounds. He was just saying that it would upset the jury, perhaps.
It might inflame the jury in an otherwise inflammatory case. I mean, the question I have is whether it's prejudice at all to put on the factual evidence, which is the basis of the claim, which the expert is relying upon. How can that be prejudice to anybody?
Right. Well, it's prejudicial in the fact that it hurts Froffitt's case.
Well, that's not
but
what
it's
prejudice
not unfair
is.
Prejudice.
Prejudice is not that it hurts you. Prejudice is that it's unfair in the sense that it's out of bounds. Now, whether it's really out of bounds or arguably out of bounds is the measuring. But if it's not prejudicial, period, in the sense that it's not wrongful to even mention it, then it should come in.
Absolutely, and that's what the Commonwealth is asserting, is that it was not unfairly prejudicial. It did not lead a jury to make it. It would not lead a jury to make a decision on an improper ground.
To state it differently, we don't prejudice juries by giving them accurate facts from competent witnesses who are testifying under oath. That's not prejudice. The only time we prejudice juries is when we give them witnesses who should not be speaking to a subject on matters that really are not terribly relevant, if at all, to the subject at hand, and add some coloration to the case that obviously evoke emotions unrelated to the case. It seems hardly to be the situation here.
Counsel, I completely agree with Justice Kelsey about the factual evidence that supports the sexually violent predator charge, which would be the latter of the two rapes. Would you focus in on why you argue that the first rape, the one that was null prost, is in fact not unduly prejudicial? I think that's the more difficult of the two facts.
Right. Yes, Your Honor. So the first rape, which was unadjudicated, occurred in 2007 against AG, and it was charged, but then, as Your Honor mentioned, it was null prost. But of course, the details of an unadjudicated offense are no less relevant or less probative than the details of a convicted offense.
Well, you would agree if he'd been acquitted, that would be a problem.
Well, not necessarily. Of course, in Ellison versus Commonwealth, this court had held that at a sexual violent predator trial where a victim testified to the details of the offense where the respondent had been acquitted of, that was allowable because that was found, he was acquitted because under a higher standard of that there wasn't proof beyond a reasonable doubt, and so it didn't stop the Commonwealth from.
Well, if it comes in under an acquittal, then a fortiori wouldn't it come in for an unadjudicated.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Wouldn't it come in, if that's true, then it's even stronger argument for it coming in for an unadjudicated.
Absolutely. So where there hadn't been any ruling at all, it would be even more relevant for...
Where does the train stop, though? I mean, if you're going to allow unadjudicated offenses, certainly the defense can say, well, what they're saying isn't true. And we're going to bring in a bunch of witnesses to show that this person's unreliable, they've got a terrible track record, they've accused a bunch of other people, etc. And aren't you getting away from what the trial is all about, which is whether or not this person has a mental abnormality?
Right. And so, but to prove whether he has a mental abnormality, it's important to show what he's done in the past because it's the basis of diagnosing him with those conditions.
But if there's a factual question about what he's done in the past.
Right.
And that's what happens when you start allowing unadjudicated offenses into evidence because it might be disputed. We don't know why the Commonwealth null prost that case, but you're going to have to find out if you put that witness on.
Right, and it might be disputed, but I don't think it would be too distracting from the central focus of the case. It would be one piece of evidence in the totality of all the evidence presented. I mean, just as in this case, the evidence of the multi-basic sex inventory 2 psychological assessment was put into evidence, and that was contested by Proffitt. I mean, each piece of evidence is going to be contested.
And for all we know, the defendant could have threatened or persuaded the victim to null prost, which is not at all unheard of in trial courts.
But null prosts are done by the Commonwealth's attorney, not by the victims. So, I mean, I would find that unusual, but it could be possible. But you'd have to find out about that. You'd have to have a trial about that. That's the problem.
Well, why don't we have the trial on why it was null prost? I mean, that there might be issues that the respondent might raise in that. As to contest whether or not
it might be the victim shut down and the victim says, I'm not saying anything more to anybody else, and the prosecutor has absolutely nothing to go on, which happens quite a lot.
Which I'm not debating why it happened. I'm just saying that all those things would have to come into this trial once you start letting unadjudicated facts into evidence.
But I would note in Ellison versus Commonwealth, which this court heard, I mean, that wasn't an issue in that case, where the Commonwealth presented a victim of a charge that he was actually, that the respondent was actually acquitted of. And also, it's not an issue in future dangerousness determinations, where prosecution can present evidence of past unadjudicated crimes in order to show a defendant's future dangerousness to
him. So your response is the fact that we might have a trial within a trial on that rape, that's just the way it goes. You put on your victim, he puts on whatever evidence he wants to put on, and that's just the price we pay to determine whether this person has to be detained or not.
Absolutely. I mean, if that comes to it, I mean, it would be contested like the other pieces of evidence are contested. I mean, just like as each diagnosis was contested in this case and the piece of evidence there. So, and I don't think it would substantially just distract from the issue before the jury.
You had wanted to reserve 5 minutes of your time. You may use your time any way you'd like, but you're down to 4 minutes and 10 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor. If there's no further questions at this time, I'll reserve the remainder time for rebuttal.
Good morning, Your Honor. May I please the court? My name is John Stacey. I'm one of the attorneys for the appellee, Mr. Proffitt, in this matter. To make a long story short, we do not believe that the trial judge abused his discretion in excluding these witnesses from this.
You need to talk a little louder. That microphone is primarily for the purpose of recording and not for amplification.
It's good to know, Your Honor. I apologize for that. Is it better? Everyone hear me now?
Yeah.
Thank you. Simply put, we do believe that the exclusion of both those witnesses was proper. At the end of the day, the main issue that we're dealing with in these matters is whether there was a sexually violent offense underlying, which we conceded long ago that there was, whether or not there's a mental abnormality or personality disorder, which we were contesting, and whether or not he is going to be a future danger to society.
The counsel on that second prong, under the DSM-4, in order to show the disorders, you have to show the existence over a span of time. It would seem that the direct evidence of a similar crime over a span of years is remarkably probative of either or both of those disorders.
Certainly it is potentially probative of those matters, Your Honor.
If it is indeed probative, I'd take out potentially, I believe it is probative, then we have to weigh how probative versus undue prejudice. Not prejudice. Every bit of evidence that comes in against any party is prejudicial to that party, but undue prejudice. So how do they get it wrong in terms of the weight between the probative nature and the undue prejudice in your mind?
How does
the argument of, excuse me, the argument of the Commonwealth is not so
certainly, Your Honor. I believe at the end of the day we're looking at the evidence that goes towards that second prong, which I believe that's where that evidence would go to. And that is not the sole piece of evidence, but that is one portion of evidence for that. There are a number of facets that were listed out in the DSM-5 and in the other numerous tests that Dr. Nevin had performed. This is only one portion of that test. And
but the point is, Dr. Nevin obviously had to go to the DSM-4 and 5 and make that assessment. He relied upon hearsay information that he could not, or she or whomever, could not put into the record because of our expert rules. And in every case where a trial lawyer is putting on an expert relying upon reasonably reliable hearsay, if you want that information before the fact finder, you actually got to call the people that's being relied upon. That's all the Commonwealth did here. If this happened in a civil case, I would think the same thing, which is why in the world this is not directly relevant to the expert opinion on the core issue in the case.
And Your Honor, I believe that's where the balancing test actually comes into play here.
But what's prejudicial about a crime victim coming into court and saying, this person sexually raped me? The prejudicial is no one wants to have that said about them. If that's prejudice, then, as Justice Mims just pointed out, all evidence is prejudice if it comes in from the other side.
And I agree, Your Honor, but the distinction there is that is a solely criminal matter. This is categorized as a civil matter, with quasi-criminal protections that go along with it. So I think it certainly deserves a degree of closer evaluation or scrutiny when it comes to the evidence that's going to come in. In the criminal case, for example, if it's going to be determined whether or not this is a rape matter, that evidence is going to be highly probative. I certainly would not disagree with that. That's how you prove your case.
Whether this guy is a sexual predator, you're suggesting the possibility that the fact that he has raped two individuals within a certain block of time ahead of time with roughly the same modus operandi is not also highly probative?
I would submit that the probative value, especially in the first allegation, is highly suspect.
Why?
Where that matter was, null prosequi. There was no opportunity to go into it. So
why wouldn't, if you're a fact finder, want to know more about AG? Which is, all right, so the expert's telling me that that's something that's being relied upon. I want to know more about that to judge the expert's opinion. And the fact that it didn't go to a verdict one way or the other makes it all the more important to know what actually is the truth.
And with respect to that, I think I disagree with that, Your Honor. The main concern with that is suddenly you're having a criminal trial with criminal elements and criminal emotions coming into a civil panel where that range doesn't come into play, or where that those emotions simply typically aren't seen. And more
importantly, counsel, in an SVP proceeding, there you can't help but have the evidence of criminal acts, because the criminal acts are the necessary predicate to get to a sexually violent predator proceed.
Yes, Your Honor, it's actually the sexual conviction that's required for that under that statute, and that comes in almost every time by the actual conviction of the underlying offense, which I submit that that conviction order is going to be the best evidence of that.
Well, you're missing what he just said. Of course that comes in, and that's the predicate for being able to even bring the civil action, but you still have an enormous burden as a Commonwealth to demonstrate the elements of civil commitment. And that's where all of these other crimes and unadjudicated acts are obviously logically relevant. And the only reason they're prejudicial is the defense knows how relevant they are.
Counsel, I want to focus actually momentarily on MJ based upon the information that you just, the argument you just made. Is your argument that once you put in the certified copy of the conviction order, that subsequent to that, it would be improper, it would necessarily be unduly prejudicial to put the victim on the stand?
Yes, Your Honor. I think that is part of what our argument was, that that creates a cumulative issue. The conviction's already there. It's information's already before the court. All you're doing is just pouring on more of the same information at that point.
So you cannot prevail on this unless we adopt that as a rule, because you are not arguing that this is distinct from any other criminal conviction and any other victim in an SVP proceeding.
I think that's correct, Your Honor.
But I think what you're saying is once the fact that the rape is established, the details would not necessarily be relevant in determining whether or not the individual was a sexually violent predator. Because, the expert said there was a rape that occurred. They didn't say whether it mattered, whether it happened by the oil wells, or whether it happened in the school gym, or whether it happened at church. It would not be relevant to whether the person was a sexually violent predator.
As far as the evaluation for the purpose of this hearing, I would actually agree with that position, yes.
How could that possibly be? If a psychiatrist went to the witness stand in an SVP proceeding and had the DSM-5 in front of him or her, and someone were to say, really, the only thing you need to rely upon is how many conviction orders are in the circuit court logs, that is not even, that's the very threshold question. It would be so far beneath the burden of persuasion necessary from that expert. So how can it be that the details can't, or are, as a matter of law, irrelevant?
Wouldn't it depend on the expert? I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Wouldn't it depend on the expert, whether they think it's relevant or not? If the expert says it doesn't matter whether the rape happened, the thing I'm concerned about is the fact that he committed a rape. Then why are the details important?
Well, Your Honor, I do believe that it is going to be expert-specific. Each expert may have their own particular favorite tests, evaluations, or scenarios that they want to follow through. But it's not based just upon the criminal convictions that he has, as was indicated by the by the Commonwealth in the motion and in the joint appendix. That expert had an opportunity to review not just his history, not just his conviction, but also interviews with Mr. Proffitt.
That's the whole point. Did this expert ever say, I don't really care about the details, I don't need to know the facts, I'm just going to look that there was a rape, there was two rapes, so I'm going to testify he's a sexually violent predator? Is that what he said?
No, Your Honor. It was a totality in reviewing both the interview with Mr. Proffitt, the past convictions, the reports that come with those convictions, the numerous tests that were also added, the results that came back from those, even though she could actually lay out how those tests were scaled, she was still relying on those as well.
Right, so, but in this specific case, wasn't the Commonwealth's position that he had committed multiple sexual assaults in a similar manner and therefore was likely to do so again, which is the whole point of civil commitment?
That was part of their theory, yes.
So in that case, how would you argue that the details don't matter?
I would say it's not so much that the details don't matter, it's the manner in which those details are presented that is the crux of the issue.
How else would you present them? If the expert can't go into it
right there, then there's certainly opportunity to have the jury sequestered away and have the witness testify at that time. Testify at that point in front of the doctor. That way, it's still on record. There's a record of it, but it's not unduly tainting the jury with that.
But the jury's a fact finder.
But all the expert is still going to say is, I've heard this witness, and I find that this person is unduly dangerous. And the jury's going, okay, wonder why he thought that.
I'm not sure I understand the question at all.
It wasn't really a question.
I have a question for you. I'm interested to know something that's related to a question that Justice McCullough asked. Because I think it goes to my concern that we're not entirely sure what questions we have to answer. But I've read this quote ruling of the trial court several times. And I don't see a ruling on prejudice versus relevance. And I want to get your answer, because if the court agrees, we only answer the relevance question. Here's what the trial court said. I cannot see how that would do anything. It would inflame the jury, perhaps. Let me stop right there. To me, that it might inflame the jury. It would inflame the jury, maybe. That's what that means to me. It's not even a ruling on the subject. But then the next part is a ruling. But, so it's a transition. But I don't need to decide that. But, I don't think it could add the relevant issue or anything relevant to the two issues that remain. So I'm going to grant his motion not to allow them to testify. When I read that, I see that the court granted this motion based on relevance and not upon weighing probative value versus prejudicial impact. Now, what do you have to say about that?
Right, that certainly is an interesting way of looking at that one. I had gone through the entire matter looking at both the relevance and as the unduly prejudicial analysis. So, As far as limiting to just a relevance question, certainly that holding does go to that. But I think at least the lip service approaching analysis from the trial judge as to the unduly prejudicial does at least bring that issue forward. I think that still makes that a relevant issue for the purposes of this proceeding.
The counsel, for purposes of this proceeding and your argument, the testimony would be relevant.
Yes, Your Honor, it could be relevant.
Thank you for saying that. I know it was hard. Thank you for saying that.
Is there anything further?
Your Honor, as I've already indicated, I do believe that the exclusion of those witnesses was proper in light of the unduly prejudicial evaluation. I would ask the court to affirm the trial court's ruling as to that matter.
All right. Thank you very much. Rebuttal, you have 4 minutes and 2 seconds.
Thank you. May I please the court? Your Honor, another factor here is that the Commonwealth was denied the opportunity to present its full arsenal of evidence in this case. And it's important, since the Commonwealth has the burden of proof, to properly show the whole narrative of evidence and give all the evidence to the jury so it can make a fully informed decision. The fact that the conviction for sexually violent offense was in evidence, of course, is part of the elements to be met, but again, that conviction itself doesn't give the underlying details that form the basis of the mental abnormality or personality disorder. That is one element of defense, but we still have to prove that Proffitt has a mental abnormality or personality disorder that inclines him to commit sexually violent offenses. And to do that, we need to show the details of the offenses and also both adjudicated and unadjudicated sexual offenses. And the trial court really, in its ruling, seemed that it just did not allow the Commonwealth to present or to move past a prima facie case. In its ruling and what it stated, it noted that, well, Dr. Nevin had partially addressed some of these issues. You know, there's minimal evidence in, so the trial court decided to cut off the presentation of evidence there. And it failed to note the probative value of the victim's testimony and also the sufficient difference in the kind and degree of their testimony about the details of the offense from Dr. Nevin's testimony about of her psychological analysis and Proffitt's risk of reoffending. And so in sum on that, Your Honors, the details of both adjudicated and unadjudicated sexual offenses committed by a respondent are highly relevant and not unfairly prejudicial in these sexually violent predator civil commitment cases. They're important for both the fact finder and the experts to consider. It's important for the expert to consider in order to make their opinions even less speculative. And so it was harmful error and abuse of discretion for the trial judge to exclude MJ and AG from testifying about the details of Proffitt raping them. Therefore, the Commonwealth would ask this court to find that the testimony of MJ and AG is relevant and admissible, and to find that the trial court abused its discretion, committed harmful error by excluding their testimony, and to reverse the trial court's decision and remand the case for new trial. There's no further questions.
Thank you very much. The court will be in recess until 11:30. All right.